As you know, I'm teaching through the most important book of the New Testament, Paul's epistle to the Romans. And I feel it's time to say I'm not just writing these languages on the board, create a modern art display, nor is this a class in linguistics. The Protestant Church is but a limb off of the trunk of the Catholic Church. And 1 3/4 time the age of the United States, the church was nationalized by Constantine, and the Council of Nicaea required a forced vote, and if they didn't vote on the decrees of the Council of Nicaea, they were banished, excommunicated, and banished from the empire. And two of those, only two, who would not sign off on it, even though the emperor himself, Constantine, wavered till his deathbed. Two who would not sign off were excommunicated and banished, and one of those screamed a truth as he went out the door at some who had opposed some of the decisions but then signed off. Scream, you're not signing because you believe. You're signing because you don't want to happen to you what's happening to me. You don't want to be banished and exiled. He was right. And very little is known of those 130 years, more closely 180 years from the death of Christ until the Council of Nicaea. The oldest Greek Bibles that exist, the language for the Old Testament translated from the Hebrew to the Greek between 300 and 100 B.C. The Septuagint was the Bible of the New Testament. And the New Testament in Greek, the oldest manuscripts we have, or copies are down in the room of the book, 4th century, about 340 A.D. they were written, after the Council of Nicaea. Both the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus, about 340 A.D., copies down in the room of the book. The Alexandrinus, 5th century, copy also in the room of the book. And the Alexandrinus, strangely enough, has the letter A in all the codes for Bible scholars. Tischendorf, when he discovered the Sinaiticus a century earlier in its date, would not accept taking second fiddle, so he adopted the sigla for that of the Hebrew first letter, Aleph. And it still is signified that way. None of those Bibles, none of those documents were available when the King James was written. The earliest they had was of the Gospels and Acts, also in the room of the book, station 29, and also station 9, the Bezae manuscript of the first, the Gospels plus Acts. The rest of their manuscripts were 9th and 10th. None of the oldest manuscripts were available when the King James was written. I'm not against the King James. I use it. Its strength is men who still believed in miracles, men who were assigned to committees that worked on separate sections and then had to cross-file, prevented a singular voice warping the word with a private theological view. But there is no question but what this book, the King James, did not have access to the oldest manuscripts. More than 5,000 have been found since this was translated. Christianity began in the Middle East. I'm teaching, and I have only one interest. I don't try to convert anybody. There would be no Christianity today if God had not stopped Paul on the Damascus Road, and the resurrected Christ taught him for 3.5 years. He didn't have the exposure to the historic Christ before the death and resurrection. His Christ's so-called brother James, made the head of the church of Jerusalem, opposed Christ. His whole family opposed Christ. Didn't believe in him, thought he was beside himself, and would lay hands on him, as most of you would do to your relative if they made the claims that Jesus made about himself. It took the resurrection to convince James. 19 years after he was appointed pastor, the Pharisees came to him and thought he would deny that Jesus was Messiah. That's the impact he had had for 19 years in Jerusalem. They still thought he would deny that Jesus was Messiah. James headed the church, and at that point, 19 years later, he declared Jesus was Messiah, and they martyred him. But the facts are, James would have made Christianity but a splinter group on Judaism. The way to heaven is keeping the law, the Torah, and you believe in Jesus Christ as Messiah. Nothing changes in your behavior except the additive element, Jesus is Messiah. First council, James presided. The fight was over the law, works, and whether or not Gentiles could even be brought into this Judaic frame without conforming to the proselyte rules of the law for converting a Gentile into Judaism. He lost the battle at the first council in Acts because of the prevailing arguments of Paul, but he still split it. He said, okay, Peter and I will go to the Jews, and Paul and Barnabas, you can go to Gentiles, and we'll concede they can be converted. And they don't have to keep the whole law, but they've got to keep the kosher law. And then he says, remember the poor, as the King James says it. The word's Ebionites. It's still a sect in the Middle East today. It was the name of the church at Jerusalem that James pastored. They prided themselves in calling themselves the poor. Now, I'm interested in one thing, and that's digging through the layers of tradition to what did Paul say? If I can find that. You know, I lost my faith in college, came back with a study of the resurrection, convinced that Jesus was who he claimed to be. I wouldn't accept the canonization of the books that the churches had done. I'd settle it for myself. And another 3.5 years I spent just studying Jesus' own use of the Old Testament and exposing myself to his attributing authority from God and inspiration to these books. Eventually I found I was retracing the steps that sound scholars had made. This book was not canonized in its containment. Ezra did it for the Old Testament, but they still clear through the history of the Masoretes, the history of the canonization of the Old Testament is a lifetime pursuit. It wasn't until councils of churchmen in North Africa long after Nicaea that the canon was stamped and the decision was made by the church, these are the inspired books. After wars, even these three oldest books that we have copies of in the room of the book will contain some books not eventually canonized. Now, my interest is, having decided and declared to the world, they say to me, what's your denomination? Well, I've been a part of this fellowship because the fellowship is that. It's a fellowship more than a denomination with strictures of control on every thought and action that you do. I'm a Paulinist. I am convinced the disciples would have followed James Christianity would have been a minor splinter group on Judaism with a belief that Jesus was Messiah. And if God had not grabbed Paul on the Damascus Road, the gospel would have been lost. And of course, there are some scholars that say Jesus didn't start Christianity, Paul did. No, Paul finished what Jesus started, and Paul made the reason for Jesus' coming applicable and understandable. And he, of all people, understood the New Testament is enfolded in the Old, and the Old Testament unfolds in the New. And without Paul, there'd be no Christianity. And I said to my friend yesterday, you know, I don't have any trouble with James. I think he's a jerk, but I don't have any trouble with James. I've preached on James. He craftily uses Scripture and lies about Abraham, lies about Rahab. Said they were, to try to argue with Paul, he says Rahab was saved by works. Well, she's a prostitute and a liar. I mean, a lot of people join that church in a hurry. Said Abraham was saved by works and not by faith because he offered up Isaac. My Bible says that Abraham, at the bottom of the hill, said to the servants as he took Isaac up the hill, we, not I, we shall return. That's faith, not works. He, and the book of Hebrews says this, he had reached a point of trusting God, finally settling it that Isaac was the seed of promise, that if God told him to go offer that son, which was but a type of what God stopped him from doing, but God did, God would raise his son up. That's what the book of Hebrews says. That's faith, friends, not works. I don't have any trouble with James. Martin Luther, the great reformer, said he didn't even write the epistle. Martin Luther, the great reformer, says write strawy little epistle, not one word of gospel in it. And most of these people I'm quoting didn't have to deal too much with James. Paul had to grab the truth of why Jesus came and what Jesus accomplished, and two-thirds of the New Testament comes from his pen. And at the church council, as I said to friends last night, when James reluctantly conceded that we Gentiles could be converted, James says, okay, Peter and I will go to the Jews, and you ought to read the epistle of James and read what the opening passage says, who he's writing to. He says, Peter and I will go to the Jews, and Paul, you and Barnabas go to the Gentiles. So based on the first church council in Acts 13, I'm a Gentile. And if there's a conflict between James and Paul, James said, Paul, go to the Gentiles, and we, James and Peter, will go to the Jew. So by James' own order, I better listen to Paul rather than James. Now, plenary inspiration of Scripture says, if we could be there, hear the words, be familiar with the reportive meanings of the words when they're uttered, know the context, the scene, the occasion, the frame of reference, and know and be able to ask, if we could, the speaker, now, did you mean this by that word? If you were speaking English and he says post, you're talking about a mailbox, fence post, or breakfast cereal. But if we could know what the speaker meant and what the occasion was that called forth the word and the tone and frame of reference, we would have the pure, inspired utterance of God. It's like in law and like in history. I learned early on in history, there is no such thing as historic certainty. By definition, historic certainty, every logically available piece of evidence must be there. And when you can no longer be an eyewitness, that logically available evidence is no longer available in fact. So all historic facts, once they occur and pass, proving them becomes relative. That's the task when you're facing a jury in law. And witnesses will differ in the way they tell the story and what they see. And the broken telephone made famous by Jack Parr and then Johnny Carson. Tell somebody on the front of the row, let them whisper to the end of the row, show the audience on TV, which isn't out like mine, because I could look at the TV and see what was said. When it came out on the end, it went in close. Broken telephone. My job as a teacher, once I accept that God gave to Paul the message of the gospel, my job, unravel what he said. Dig beneath the surface. Go back behind the theological controversies where men were threatened with excommunication if they didn't put the tone on the word. There are many words in every language that are ambiguous, and if you're going to be hung and quartered or sent to the mines, if you interpret the word a bit off the fixed by the third and fourth centuries theological view, my realism view of mankind tells me they'll either leave it ambiguous or bend it their way. I'm digging back because most people have forgotten what I've been telling you. Nobody knows how this marvelous Ethiopic language and when it was transferred and translated into Ethiopic from the Greek scriptures. It's so easy to read in Acts past the fact of the Ethiopian eunuch who was the assistant to the queen of Ethiopia. And all I know, some scholars try to rewrite the geography of the day. She was the queen of Ethiopia. He was her servant. He's reading from the book of Isaiah. Why wouldn't he have scrolls? The contact with Israel goes back to the queen of Sheba and King Solomon. They still fight over where the ark go. And, you know, my sense of humor tells me Solomon, with all the options he had, he probably made a replica for her. I can't really think that he made a replica and put it in the temple and sent the real one with her. But Ethiopia is still one of the sites for those that are looking for the ark. Raiders of the Lost Ark didn't go there. Ethiopia's history goes clear back to Genesis. It is one of the most precise languages ever formed by man. Dillman, the great German scholar, says some superior intellect people conceived this language that looks like hieroglyphics. But 210 letters in the alphabet give you a precision not matched in any other language. You that have been coming here know, as I moved into the 22nd verse, the issue is the righteousness of God displayed first in our belief in Jesus or in the faith of Jesus himself first and then get to us? Staggering in its implications, and they conceive in modern Greek grammar the debate between genitive case, is it subjective or objective? Is when you say the love of God is God loving us or the love we have for God. That's a modern wrinkle, and it's interesting that it's illustrated with English, which is very ambiguous. You don't have that problem yet in the Ethiopic. When it puts the word down, you got the righteousness, Sedeka. You use the letter out of 210 that has the A vowel in the form of it, which tells you that it's possessed by the next word. You don't have any debate about it. It is the Sedeka or righteousness of God, the next word, which in their long word, Exi Abker, is Lord of the land. You don't have ambiguity. Somewhere, nobody knows when, at least about the 3rd century, the whole kingdom was converted. And long before Nicaea, and long before the manuscripts we have, someone, one to God, translated these New Testament earliest documents from Greek into Ethiopic. Well, I said to my friends last night, I said, you know, the reason they were so powerful as a witness in the New Testament. The preachers had experiences we don't have. If you were riding along in a chariot, reading the book of Isaiah, and a guy stops you on the road, and you ask him, well, I don't understand it. Can you explain it? He explains it. He explains who the Messiah is that prophesied in Isaiah 53, because that's the passage he was reading. Converts you, convinces you of the resurrected Christ, and baptizes you. And you're just getting up ready to, you know, rejoice with him. And like a la Star Trek, he just disappears in front of your eyes. Dematerializes. Gone. I want to tell you something. You come and deliver the message to me and convert me and just dematerialize. I'm hooked. See, the difference between me and most academics and scholars, where I would be if I were in a university, they don't believe in miracles. I've had the courage to say from day one when I lost my faith, if Jesus didn't come out of that tomb, I want no part of Christianity. I don't need it. I don't even like the golden rule. Do unto others that which you would have them do unto you. Don't you try that with me. I don't want you doing to me what you want done to you. Give me Confucius. Don't do to others what you don't want done to yourself. So on a practical, empirical level, you can't sell Jesus to me. I'm confronted with one thing, the same thing Paul was confronted with. The fact of the resurrection, and I like his courage. He says in 1 Corinthians 15, if Christ be not risen from the dead, our faith is vain. We're a bunch of liars. We're false witnesses because we've testified God raised him from the dead. I remember saying to Lex Miller, my lead professor, the famous New Zealand theological, ethical theologian, contemporary associate of Niebuhr at Union before he took over religion department at Stanford, studied under Karl Barth in Germany. We were close enough. I said to him, Lex, you get teary-eyed. You get teary-eyed and cry when you talk about God speaking his word and from nothing the galaxies of the heavens swirled forth and the creation sprung forth from nothing. Now, how come you can't get equally teary-eyed over a lesser miracle? And that's a much lesser miracle, the resurrection, than speaking and nothing becoming everything that we aren't even close to exploring. Why can't you get teary-eyed about the resurrection? Because you will not and refuse to base your faith on the resurrection. You want to base it on things Jesus said. He said, Gene, I just am afraid that the resurrection won't stand up to the test, and I don't want to risk my faith on that chance. I went away thinking, you know, I'm not going to tell you what I thought. I mean, you know, he had just tried to convince me of things about my life. Without the resurrection, I'm going to say it loud and clear, Christianity's a bunch of nonsense. And it's a bunch of losers who bet on the wrong horse and then to save face came up with this wild-eyed story. He either came out of the tomb or he's one of the great losers of history. And with the resurrection, I don't have trouble believing the rest of it. I believe in miracles, which is why if you're going to pursue the manuscripts back, go back to the stage when they still had experienced miracles. This Ethiopian eunuch went back with a testimony and a hunger. Nobody knows where Arabia got its scriptures. When did they translate the New Testament into Arabic? Nobody knows. But I know this. Many Christians, as I said a Sunday or two ago, have read through the book of Acts and absolutely registered nothing. When, as this Ethiopian eunuch would testify of being told this story by a man dematerialized in front of his eyes. You read in Acts, after the Damascus Road experience, when the Lord spoke to him out of the heavens, blinded him, sent him to a man that didn't even know his, he'd never seen him before, knew about him, and gets his eyes healed. The scripture says he spent 3.5 years in Arabia and back to Damascus. You're going to tell me after that experience, Paul wasn't testifying of the reality of the resurrected Christ when he was 3.5 years in Arabia? You're going to tell me he didn't make converts that would get copies of his writings? The Arabic, and the Arabic Christians have been long neglected in the history of the church. Where were Christians first called Christians? Antioch. Antioch is Syriac. Antioch is Syriac and the first kingdom to convert, Edessa, and down in the, just outside the room of the book. In the Syriac display, we have a copy of Simonides' document. The colophon says, Nicholas the deacon, one of seven named in Acts, had Matthew dictate the gospel to him, copy of which is down there, 15 years on their calendar, but translated 15 years, 48 A.D., after the death and resurrection of Christ. Bartholomew translated it, took it to Edessa. Edessa was the first kingdom. One of the great proofs that the Jesus Seminar ignores the obvious. Tatian's Diatessaron, a harmony of the four Gospels, completed in 160 A.D. in Syriac, which means they had to be translated, accepted as genuine and approved, and circulated without electronics that go out like this, and then put into a harmony by 160 A.D., which became the Bible of the Syriac church. I have a letter right there inside my binder that just came from the successor to George Lamsa, Robert Allen, Jr., requesting that I write the introduction to their current publication of George Lamsa's translation of the Syriac Bible into the Peshitta. The language of Galilee that they cried out about in Acts 2, well, these are Galileans, and yet we hear them speak in all these different tongues. Syriac, a dialect of the Aramaic, was spoken in Galilee. When they say to Jesus, his speech betrays him. Syriac, the Galilean and Antiochian and Edessan dialect of Aramaic. All linguists are amazed. Aramaic, without a country conquering, Aramaic ruled from 700 years before Christ to the Muslim invasion 700 years after Christ. Aramaic ruled, and then the Jews come back from Persia. It was the language of the Western Persian Empire, and they come back speaking Aramaic. Not Syriac, but Aramaic, the mother tongue of which Syriac is a dialect. And in Nehemiah 8, they discover the Torah, and you read in Nehemiah 8:8, the people stood and they read, but the people had forgotten their Hebrew tongue in the 70 years in Babylon. And it says, they read from the Torah, and then the teachers translated and explained the meaning to the people who understood Aramaic. And from that come the Targums, which means translation. That when we're in the Old Testament, I've oft used, because the Targum is the Aramaic translation, ultimately written down, originally oral explanations to a crowd, as I do here. These languages have pretty much been buried under the Greek, the Hebrew, and the Aramaic, and the Latin. As I hear it, the new movie that's creating the controversy called The Passion has them speaking Latin. Well, some of the centurions might have, but the language of Jerusalem was Aramaic and Greek. The conquerors would stamp their language on the educated as the language of the world today. We got a problem or everything okay? Okay? I'm ready for anything today. Problems galore. I can see you now. Is everything okay? Okay. If they have a problem, she's the one to go to when I'm preaching. Hi, Sam. How many miles you ride on a bicycle this past week? 200?
Not as many as you.
Well, I bet you did. He's clever. Sam's Patty Glazer's husband. He's an ex-pro football player from, what was it, Pittsburgh Steelers? Or is that it? I mean, you know, you can't lose with an attorney who's married to a Pittsburgh Steelers professional football player. This must be soon, and Patty here. You've been outside, Patty, dealing with the problem. I hope you tell the mayor. I don't want to sue him, but I will. Now, what are you saying? Just say it.
We need to put the power back on.
Huh?
You need to press your button and the TV will come on.
I need to press a button? I'm good at that. Get over here. I don't have to learn these things. I'm like Henry Ford. I can pay 100 people to punch those kind of buttons. I don't see anything happening. Why should I feel discouraged? These languages, Greek, as I was saying, was superimposed because the Greeks ruled the world in the Bible age. The Greeks ruled in Egypt. It was in Egypt they translated the Old Testament into the Greek, the Septuagint. Greek was the language of the educated, as across the world today, English has taken the place of French. And to be able to make it in the world, and whoever's continuing to cough, slip out. I have sneezing fits of 16 and 20. So, go out and cover the foyer with snot, and then come back. Well, I want to be listened to in here, not the sneezer. I'm coming to the end of this. I'm going to preach a sermon today. I'm laying the foundation. These languages are necessary to get behind the crust from the 4th century on. We're not going to find major changes. We have another attorney here, Ken, who pointed out to me and brought me an article from the New York Times. You know, just now, there are scholars in the Muslim world doing to the Quran what I'm doing as I raise the possibility that the King James was not good enough for Paul, so it doesn't have to be good enough for me. As I heard one preacher say, King James good enough for Paul is good enough for me. I'm digging back to the sources until we can take a verse and understand we've gone as close as we can to what Paul meant. This is not just academic. The verse we're working with, but now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested. Law is very ambiguous. Whose law? When you write it in the Hebrew, they have to have a righteousness, adlu, Allah. You have to have this little vowel up here because modern translators would say the fairness of God, but it's the fairness of who? If you don't have that little gizmo up there, there is no such thing using this word as law without identifying from whom it comes. The Greek? Noonie de Korus, from which we get chasm? Nomu? We've been two Sundays on Nomu, Nomos. It has, in the Greek world, an ambiguity of meaning beyond our word for law. It's everything from a personified goddess in the mythological pantheon to a principle to the polis being formed and the state being deified and whatever it says to a host of other ambiguous things. What law does he mean as he pulls this word out? And what does he mean without the law? The Greek is kōris, which is chasm. Now that's simply saying distance. But how much distance? I mean, James obviously cuts the law up a bit and says that this new way can be split and the Jew does all of it and the Gentile just does the kosher. Chasm is a bit ambiguous. And you ask yourself, when you come to the Ethiopic and you come to the Syriac and they have a cognate of that word, kōris, why didn't they just translate it kōris? The word had some meanings that it lost. We say, that ball in tennis today, when it hits the net. That's about the only place in modern English that it retains the old meaning to restrain. Let ball means it's restrained for the net. Yet the King James uses that old word when in Thessalonians it says concerning the hindering force of Antichrist, he that letteth will let until he be taken out of the way. Let in modern English means to allow, not to restrain. So either this word kōris, as well as nomu, kōris had a tone of meaning that it lost by the time the 3rd century came along, or the 6th and 10th century, and simply without doesn't quite embrace it. Doesn't even say what kōris says. Kōris says there's a chasm between the righteousness now being unfolded and law. Chasm can be big, little, but you go and it begins to dawn upon you, as I had a very respected scholar say through a friend of mine in recent weeks, you know, as I listen to these words peeled apart, it's becoming very apparent that these Middle Eastern devoted sources had some manuscripts that we don't have. Because instead of nomu, an ambiguous word, the Arabic falana barir al-sharia, not just a chasm, with no connection to, is what this word means, with no connection to sharia. And sharia suddenly conjures up the theological state of Muslim, but sharia existed before Muhammad came along. It's a law of works, do this and don't do that, that has a halo around it of divinely ordered performance, perfectionizing as a way to eternity. You go into the Ethiopic, a righteousness of God, while using the root word gabra, which is to enslave or slave, while not enslaving oneself to. Kagaga, mandates, orit, just like Torah. It's their religious law. The orit to the Ethiopic church is the Octatuk, the pure Torah, the first five books, plus Joshua, Judges, and Ruth, or Esther, whichever one it is. It's eight books. Syriac, same thing. No, they borrow. So obviously the Syriac in this case uses no Musa. No Musa, same as the Greek nomos. So they must have had an understanding of the law as holy law because they go on to say it is not same as the Arabic, not having a connection. Let's go to the translation. Book of Acts says that Pharisees were converted early on. They're going to have the text translate back into the Hebrew. And it's interesting that dikaiosune, or DK word for righteousness, that in the Greek is ambiguous again, clear back to the goddess that was the daughter of Zeus that enforced his nomos. When they translate righteousness from the Old Testament, the Hebrew word is tzedek, borrowed obviously, either from the Ethiopic to the Hebrew, or from the Hebrew to the Ethiopic, and the word is a kind of righteousness that requires persons, because its meaning is gone when you put it in a context other than a person covenanting with a person, and both sides have terms of the covenant, and the problem that distinguishes God's covenant, and why we call it the Old Testament, in last wills and testament, we write all the terms. God writes the covenant, but he keeps his part, we keep our part. You do it, you get this, you don't do it, you get that. Tzedekah is a covenant keeping righteousness. It has no meaning in abstract rules apart from the source, a person, and the receiver and keeper, a person. The same is true in the Ethiopic. Righteousness is that covenanting kind of righteousness. Every one of these words, what amazes me is they had the cognate, but they chose not to use it. Arabic, Paul spent 3.5 years. Ethiopic, the Ethiopian eunuch leaps out. Christians call Christians first at Antioch. Syriac, they had to translate it. As I said, Thaddeus and Bartholomew immediately did. What I've written on the board today, Coptic, Oheric. Most people don't even think about it. To claim that Mark wrote his gospel first. Eusebius says, Mark founded the church at Alexandria. The martyrologies say Mark, after being bishop at Alexandria, was martyred by being dragged to death in the streets of Alexandria. The educated people spoke Greek, but the language of Egypt, which springs out of their hieroglyphics, which until Napoleon's soldier found the Rosetta Stone, they thought were just picture drawings, and then Champollion deciphered it, and lo and behold, we discover that the hieroglyphics was a language and an alphabet, and the demotic script still exists, and depending upon the time, classical or more modern, 9 to 7 demotic script letters that come from the old hieroglyphic script, demotic. This is a demotic letter. Looks like O, but it's CH. This is a demotic letter, which is like the Hebrew soft and silent H or ah at the end of a word. There's other demotic letters, and you know, I guess that's the only two that are demotic, but 7 to 9. The Coptic, this is Boharic, there's also Sahidic, was the language of Egypt. Sahidic is upper the Nile area, and Boharic is the area of Alexandria, and Boharic is the language of the Coptic church today. Mark, the companion of Paul, spends his ministry to martyrdom in Alexandria. Oh, I know the place in Italy that wants to claim him. He was there too with Paul. Paul in his last days says, only Luke is with me, but he says, send Mark. Mark would fail so many times. Send him, he's good for me. Paul, may or may he didn't die, that Rome's tradition says, but in any event, Mark founded the church in Egypt. The church in Egypt became one of the most powerful. It was Cyril of Alexandria that won the battle at the Council of Nicaea. To not think that there would be Coptic scripture and to think there wouldn't be New Testament scriptures translated. We're building a hall of the papyri. The oldest, I argue with that because I believe the oldest are the Magdalene fragments and the little fragment of Mark. In my judgment, and Teeley, I think, has proved it, in Cave 7 of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were closed by 70 A.D., so it puts it back that far. But in the early third of the second century, now we're before 150 A.D., the John Ryland's manuscript of the Gospel of John was found in Egypt. Found written on a piece of papyri that was scrap papyri that had been gathered up by a person who wrapped mummies. And they found this fragment with John's gospel. Clear back, first half, second century, less than 100 years from Christ, and probably less than 70 years. They think that John wrote it about 90. So we're talking less than 70 years after John wrote it. It circulated and is in Egypt. Down in the room of the book, in the hexagon of the papyri, you will see the Chester Beatty manuscripts. I'm not using it yet because it has Romans from the fifth chapter forward until I get to the fifth chapter. But in the Chester Beatty manuscripts, we have Greek, back to the early 200s, less than 150 years from the close of the New Testament, earlier than those manuscripts that are the oldest complete Bibles. And the point I'm making with the John Ryland's manuscript and with the Chester Beatty manuscript, both found in Egypt. And yet, some would think that the Christians in Egypt, by the third century, the whole pagan nation had been converted. And the language had to be in Coptic. Becoming a monk required memorizing and reading certain sections of the epistles. They had to have it in Coptic. The Coptic brings us right back as the Syriac and the Aramaic and the Arabic and the Ethiopic to those tentacles that go out. And I drew a picture in one of my books. I said, let's assume this is the Council of Nicaea and the oldest Greek Bibles that we have in the 4th century. And we go back here and we find earlier manuscripts in other languages, but all we can encounter are limbs that come forth in this 200 to 400. And these limbs, obviously, and Greek scholars call this the borlage, borrowed from the German, there's some original pattern that keeps moving along. Even these Bibles back here have a note about them. There's either in the recension pattern of the Alexandrinus or the recension pattern of the Sinaiticus. Where's the original that we're looking for? And if all of these sources in these different languages are closer to the Vorlage, and on this word nomos in the Greek, which they also have cognates here but don't use, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these other languages agree upon a specific meaning of this ambiguous word, then we probably have a source that's not ambiguous, that these 4 or 5 agree upon, and that we're not saying this is wrong, it's just too ambiguous to know which of the alternatives. These other languages give you that. That's why I'm doing this, and the Coptic is my message next Sunday. That's it. Happy birthday, and thank you. allow me one footnote. When that clock moved up there, I started hurrying. I referenced translation back into the Hebrew. They say a righteousness, Bibli, Torah. Now that's very clear, like Sharia in the Arabic phrase. Bibli describes what one brings with himself with a negative attached to it. In other words, bringing nothing, bringing nothing of Torah. So the languages split the hairs for us. And I referenced an attorney who pointed out the Muslims are just starting to do this with the Quran. The Quran, some early scholars, one in Egypt, got thrown out of the second floor by his students for questioning that Gabriel gave to Muhammad every single word exactly as we have it in the modern Quran. We got a sample on our displays back here. Others have had their car firebombed for even trying to do critical analysis of the Quran. But if you understand the Arabic, classical Quran didn't have the diacritical numbers, the dots, didn't have, I only put one up here because it's relevant to this word, the vowels. And there is a modern scholarship, you better be risking his life and know it. It's written a book on the Syrio-Aramaic connections to the Quran and the possibility that the modern interpretation could be a little wrong because the same word in Syrio-Aramaic, which was borrowed into the Arabic, and at least one ancient Arabic dictionary translates it such, the word without the diacritical points and the vowel points, which Hebrew, old Hebrew, doesn't put in your vowel points, and the little wa can be either woo or wa, or just simply a vowel, they weren't there in the ancient classical. And paradise comes from a root word that means garden. A fertile and wonderful garden like Eden. And paradise is entrance into that wondrous garden. And in Arabic lands, wine is, and grapes are a sign of wealth, and raisins dried in that climate. And the prize raisins are white raisins. And when guests come to your house and you greet them and they come in, you offer them white raisins. Now, it so happens, Huri and Huria, if you add the vowel signs and the diacritical points, Huri and Huria, which is feminine, mean virgin. But you drop the vowels and the other things that are not in the ancient classical writing of Hebrew, or rather of Arabic. It's raisins, white raisins. So the same word could mean white raisins or virgins. And can you imagine some of these martyrs who enter paradise and they say, here's your 74 white raisins. Which is a footnote saying it's important we get to what was really said before we martyr ourselves.